Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Dan Ashley, news anchor at ABC 7 Television, KGO, and the Commonwealth Club's quarterly chair. We also want to welcome our listeners on the radio today. We are pleased to present the Walter Hoadley Annual Economic Forecast, named in honor of the club's late past president and longtime board member, Dr. Walter Hoadley. Dr. Hoadley also served most notably as chief economist and vice president of the Bank of America. We wish to thank the Walter E. Hoadley Memorial Fund and Bank of America for their generous sponsorship of today's program. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker today, Tom Campbell, Dean of the Haas School of Business at the University of California at Berkeley. And a few words about Tom. He is the 13th dean of the Haas School of Business, a position he took in 2002. His distinguished career in academia includes Stanford University Professor of Law, a position he held for 19 years. But Tom, of course, is well known to many Californians as a former state senator and United States congressman, serving in Washington for 5 terms. And although 2 campaigns for the Senate did not bear fruit, Tom has said that he will never say never to a political challenge. And as a reporter, I have yet to ask him whether he wants to join the dozens of people who seem to be running for president. But I'll get to that. Don't worry. He is firmly committed to the School of Business. Tom is leading efforts to expand the school's faculty from 60 to 90 full-time tenure-track positions. He encourages MBA students to do at least 50 hours of community service and describes the study and the pursuit of business as being noble and ennobling, since both lead to employment and opportunity. Please welcome Bank of America Dean and Professor of Business at the Haas School of UC Berkeley, Dean Tom Campbell.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Gloria. And I'm so pleased to be back with all of my friends here in San Francisco and at the Commonwealth Club. I'm also glad they got my title right, Bank of America Dean, particularly appropriate for the Walter Hoadley lecture. I wanted to use our opportunity today to talk about something that is very, very serious, but also not commonly the subject of crisis consideration, and that's the deficits. It's hard to make it recognized as essentially important as it is, but I'm going to try. So the first topic I'm going to address today is what actually is the budget deficit size, dimension in the state of California and in the United States generally. Secondly, what are the consequences? And thirdly, what might be some possible solutions? Now, to offer you some of the statistics that I'm going to be talking about, I put them on a piece of paper and had them distributed, but I'm not going to be asking you to look at them during the presentation. Just if I refer to numbers, they're there, and you can check them if you'd like later. Let me begin then with the first very simple question: what is the size of the United States federal budget deficit? Well, it's $493 billion. Some people give you a lower number, and the way they do that is they count in the amount of surplus in Social Security, right? Because Social Security, we're still paying in more than we're taking out. And so they count that, but that's bogus. That's not a fair way, because it's already spoken for. $493 billion is a fair number. State of California, I have some fun with this one. The current budget, as introduced by the governor, will probably be about $2 billion in deficit. Last year, $7.6 billion in deficit. But the year before that, fiscal year 2006, I was finance director of the state of California, and solely because of that fact, we ran a $19 million surplus, the first surplus the state of California has had in 7 years. You're welcome. I also take credit for the fact that Cal has not had a losing football season since I have been dean. and the one is about as honest a claim as the other. But it does help you put things in perspective. We were the beneficiaries of a huge burst of revenue because the stock market came back. And in California, stock market options, capital gains, comes straight in at ordinary tax rates. So that's how we were able to balance the budget the year I was finance director. More seriously is that previous years, $2 billion, $1 billion, $7 billion, $3 billion, $2 billion, $4 billion out of balance each year before I was finance director. And as I said, in the two planned years, one announced, one completed and one announced, we're still not in balance. Second, what does deficit mean? Deficit is the increment to debt. So let's talk about debt. The total amount that we owe, the United States owes $6.4 trillion. State of California owes $63 billion. Those are the total numbers. To that number that California presently owes, we ought to add $38 billion, which was authorized by all of us in November's election when California voted for more bonds, more general obligation bonds. In addition, the governor announced shortly after the State of the State address that he is interested in adding more general obligation bonds. But this isn't the whole story. When I talk about bonds and talk about total debt, I'm referring simply to pieces of paper on which is written a promise by a governmental unit, the United States or the State of California, to pay back. But there are many other promises. There are promises put in the form of statute, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. And that is something of a very different dimension. Two scholars, one at AEI, one at UPenn, working for the Federal Reserve Trust, recently did a calculation and in congressional testimony told us what the total amount of obligations of the federal government is. Not just the bonds, but the total obligations we are committed to paying. That number is $66 trillion. And I'm going to try to put that in perspective in today's presentation. And remember, that's netting out what we've already put aside in the Social Security Trust Fund, which, by the way, is a misnomer. The Social Security Trust Fund is full of IOUs. There is no gold in the Social Security Trust Fund. It has been borrowed by the federal government. Now, in the state of California, to the total amount of the indebtedness that we already have, we should add a similar calculation for promises we've made to pay, and this is largely to state employees, and they are pension benefits and health care benefits. And those two, it's an estimate, and we don't have the official numbers yet, but roughly speaking, it's about $99 billion. So $99 billion added to the amount that California already has, $63 billion, and the total for the federal government, as I said, of $66 trillion. Lest we take any pause from my recitation of worrying statistics, we haven't yet talked about cities and counties that might be in financial difficulty. And even though legally the state of California may not have to bail out, for example, the city of San Diego, which is in some financial difficulty, I'm telling you politically, as a reformed politician, that it's going to be very hard when police officers who are now retired in the city of San Diego say, my pension was what I was relying on. It's gone. Please, Sacramento, help us out. It'll be very hard for Sacramento to say no. So consider that as an additional fact. And the sum, without getting into the cities and counties in California, would be $162 billion. Well, these numbers are very hard to deal with in realistic terms. So I tried a couple of ways. One of the common ways, which is also one of the least valuable, is, well, these deficits as a percentage of GDP are not that big. Indeed, Fed Chairman Bernanke, in testimony last week, spoke about the fact that the White House often refers to the deficit as a percentage of GDP. Okay, that's not an irrelevant number, but what does it mean? It means very little. It means that we are paying our interest as it's due, and we're paying it with more borrowing. So as a financial reality, it's not a very powerful number. But so you have it, it's 2.56% of the GDP. And in California, the size of our deficit is even smaller. It's 0.2%. But that is not the right way to go about analyzing it. The question rather should be, given the amount of money we have to put aside for debt service and for these other demands, are we preventing our state and our country from having flexibility and the freedom to do something else? And there the answer is yes, very seriously we are. In fact, the amount of spoken for money in the federal budget is now above 60%. Let me repeat that. 60% of the federal budget is already committed, either in paying interest or debt service or on these entitlement programs to which I referred, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which have already been committed. And at the state of California, it's just a shade under 60%. So in both places, you're looking at the discretion to spend as 40% or less. Why does that matter? Well, there might be some new crisis that we have to deal with. Global warming wasn't much spoken of 5 years ago. God forbid there's an Ebola breakout or another Asian flu or any kind of a consequence from an emergency, which we would need to go to the budget. We might not have the flexibility to do so. But there was a new way of looking at it, and this, I hope, is a number that you take with you today and will inform the sense that I began with, is there urgency here? When you take the payback schedules, the debt service schedules that the United States and the state of California are following and that the bond rating agencies consider prudent, and you ask how long will it take to pay back just the debt, I'm not talking now about the $66 trillion, the unfunded liabilities, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, just the debt. And at the state level, I'm just talking about the general obligation bonds, not the pension and the health care of retired state employees. Just the debt. We will not be able to pay back what the federal government owes for 303 years. That's a number that brings it down to earth. That's how far we've gone. And at the state of California, it's 84 years. How did we get there? Some people say, well, look, there's a war in Afghanistan, there's a war in Iraq, there's a war on terror. Those are not the reasons. Though you would mislead yourself, because there will come a time, God willing, it'll be soon, when the war in Iraq is over, the war in Afghanistan is over, wars come and go, crises come and go. I'm speaking about the permanent commitments that are part of the structure of government, which create this duty, this obligation that constrains 60% of our freedom at the federal and the state level. And looking at the budget, 22% of the federal government budget is defense, but 61% is not. Is that mandatory spending, and it's not related to defense. The growth of entitlements shows that as well. Medicare and Medicaid since 2000 have each grown by more than 54%. To the best of my knowledge, it's not because there's any new disease or new debilitating condition or a sudden surge in people who are eligible, although that will happen, but simply because Congress has not shown the ability to constrain the growth of spending in entitlements. No new crisis yet, ever-growing component of our financial freedom is spoken for. Returning to the state, we have the following problem, and we saw it at the last election. When people vote for a bond, I wonder how often they realize that they are making a bet. And the bet, if it's a general obligation bond, is that the economy of the state is going to come roaring back so big, so strong, so quick, that the general obligation bonds will be paid. Because if they're not, we just have a increment in the burden that will crowd out other potentials for our state's priorities. Here's an example of what the right way to do it. It may be a little bit iconoclastic, but I think most of us in the room remember the Rob Reiner initiative. It proposed that there be preschool for all in California, and it went down to defeat. But what he proposed in that was a tax, an increment in tax, uniquely identified for the preschool. And I want to give him credit for being financially honest. He said, here's a new program, here's a new way to pay for it. That's not what we do when we do general obligation bonds at the federal level or at the state level. We just make the assumption. Well, what's wrong with having 60%, as I said, tied up? First of all, there could be some other crisis. Secondly, and this one I feel quite profoundly, this is a word you seldom hear from economists. Maybe that's a shame. It's immoral. It's immoral. That's not an economic concept, perhaps. But it's immoral for us to borrow from our children and spend for us. I'll return to this at the very end, but ask yourself, where is that entitlement spending going? Yes, our children will eventually be in the recipient category to take benefit, but their lifetime will be spent paying for it. Whereas those of us who are much closer to retirement age have voted for it and received the support of voters for introducing such motions in Congress. And that, I think, has some very serious questions of morality. Third is interest payments, just what economists would call deadweight loss. Well, here are the typical reactions. Well, don't we just owe it to ourselves? First of all, so what if we did? Does that mean we're not going to pay it? Dear Social Security recipient, we've now ascertained that you are, in fact, a citizen of California. So surely you'll be patriotic enough to skip your check this month because we're running a federal deficit. Sincerely yours, Social Security. I never quite got this argument that it's okay because we owe it to ourselves. Secondly, it's false. Did you know that? Last year we passed the 50% mark. Last year, 2006, for the first time in modern American history, more than 50% of our debt is owed to foreign debt holders. What's the matter with that? Let me give an example. First of all, who are they? 16% held by Japan, 10% by China, 9% by the United Kingdom, all other countries 15%. So just a shade above 50% now. There are some in the room who are old enough to remember. I was alive, but I don't quite remember the Suez Crisis of 1956. Do you remember that the United States used its influence in the bond market because we held so much of British debt that we said we will sell it all at the same time unless you, United Kingdom and France, withdraw your support from Israel, who had occupied the Suez Canal after Nasser had nationalized the Suez Canal. All right, fast forward to today. 10% of our debt is held by China. I'm not a xenophobe, and I'm not here today to say anything of close to xenophobic. But is it possible that if the United States, in its foreign policy, were to recognize Taiwan, that China might say, you do that, and we will sell all American debt on the market at one time, and watch interest rates in America skyrocket? We literally place control of our foreign policy in the hands of other countries when we rely upon them to fund our deficit. And it's not likely to get any better. United States private savings has now dropped. We are now at 0% private savings. And so we will be looking more and more to foreign countries rather than to ourselves. Well, there's a quotation that's been attributed by Secretary O'Neill to Vice President Cheney. Quote, deficits don't really matter. Reagan proved that. That's in Paul O'Neill's book after he left the administration. So I don't know if Vice President Cheney actually said that or not. But let's say that he did. Is that a fair basis to be unconcerned? It isn't, because in President Reagan's time, there was no alternative for OPEC and Japan, particularly, to invest their savings except U.S. dollars. And so we were in that happy position, if you remember Econ 101. The demand curve was moving out for borrowed money, moving to the right. The federal government was borrowing more, but the supply curve was moving even faster. More and more countries were willing to put their savings in the U.S. because the dollar was the only safe place. That's not true after the euro. The euro now exists as a place for the OPEC dollar and for the Chinese dollar and the Japanese dollar. And I'll put it to you in the following terms. Our debt service at the federal level is now $184 billion. All we would need is a small fraction of our revenue to drop. Indeed, if our revenue, our federal revenue, dropped by 9%, we would have to double that debt service Is revenue possible to drop 9%? Sure. It dropped 12% from fiscal year 2000 to fiscal year 2003. We are one stock market correction away from a massive increase in U.S. borrowing, simply to fund the debt that I've already talked about. And without the supply curve shifting out as fast as the demand curve, we will have higher interest rates. Consumer credit in the United States, as I said, cannot be the answer. We're already heavily indebted. It's now at 18%. Household debt is now 130% of income, highest in recent history. As to the state of California, I'm happy to say there is no Suez crisis likely comparison. I don't think Nevada will be dumping California debt in order to affect California's credit rating, although you got to keep your eye on Nevada at all times. But if we wish our state to engage in new concepts like health care, the governor's put forward and the legislature is working with him, you have to ask, can we do it? Can we do it by borrowing more? Well, good news. California was upgraded 3 times since the recall election by Moody's, 3 times by Fitch's, and 2 times by Standard & Poor's. Bad news, we're still at the bottom. We tie with Louisiana, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico for the lowest bond rating among all jurisdictions in the United States. If we were at the highest instead of the lowest, we would be paying $360 million less in interest every year. So I'm very worried about funding any new financing by more general obligation bonds. How about more taxes? Well, California corporate tax, number 2 in the nation, behind Pennsylvania. Personal income tax, number 2 in the nation, is the highest at the highest rate. We're at 9.3%. Vermont is the highest, so we're number 2 to them. Sales tax, we're number 1. The marginal tax on adding one extra job in our state has to be our focus, not really the average tax. But just as I told you before, some people say don't worry about the deficit as a percentage of GDP, it's small, or don't worry about the deficit because we only owe it to ourselves. There are a dozen make-you-feel-good arguments about the state's tax level, too, among them being, well, we're actually number 12 in total tax per capita, or we're number 15 in total tax per dollar of income. But that's because we have such a steeply rising income tax that we have many, many who, frankly, don't pay tax at all. The lower 48% of all California income earners pay less than 2% of the entire income tax burden in the state of California. We are exceptionally steep. At the federal level, you have a 10%, the 10% highest income, who are paying 25% of the revenue. The top 20% of federal income earners pay 33% of all revenue. So there is a very steeply rising income tax rate. And that raises this question. If you want to fund additional programs in the state, do you do it by increasing taxes when they are already very, very high compared with other states and very, very steep on the income basis? And my worry in doing so is that the jobs we want here in California are the good-paying jobs. We want those who will be paying at these top rates. It's not irrelevant for a company to make the following assessment. If I sink concrete into California, if I build in a way that makes me relatively permanent here, will I be hit at the next economic downturn? Ernst & Young's study, January 2004, said the following. From fiscal year 2000 to fiscal year 2003, only 6 states had business tax increases greater than the increase in total taxes, and we were one of them. Namely, when the next economic downturn comes, if I have made my presence in California permanent, will the state try to balance the increased costs on me? The answer is that's what we did in 2000 to 2003. We have already shown what is likely, and so we run the risk of losing business to other states. Last argument is, well, didn't the California voters already reject this? Wasn't this discussed at the initiatives election in 2005? Yes, it was, and I'm happy in our question and answer period to talk about why that particular approach failed and what might be done. But I want to conclude with a very simple suggestion for what might be done. First of all, is there a problem? At the federal level, yes, a very, very serious problem of debt and deficit. And it's not because of the war in Iraq. It's because of entitlements and our inability to pay now what we're imposing on our children to pay later. Is there a problem at the state level? Yes, but not as serious as at the federal. What harms flow from this problem? At the federal level, we place economic power in the hands of our potential adversaries. My example about the Suez Crisis, or if the United States were to recognize independent Taiwan, would China act in that manner? Huge increase in the interest rates paid in our country, one stock market correction away, because the euro is now available for the foreign supply instead of the dollar. That is a risk. And third, waste of paying interest. At the state, loss of flexibility. We don't have the flexibility to deal with new and additional needs without running the risk of losing jobs. Here's my suggestion. Democrats and Republicans, we will disagree on what the correct level of government spending is. We will disagree on how to finance what forms of taxation in our state and in our country. That is healthy. There should not be a disagreement that whatever it is we want, we pay for it. I don't think that's a Republican or a Democratic principle, that we simply stop this policy of benefiting in the current term and making the next generation pay. There are some arguments when we have to, and with this I conclude. Franklin Roosevelt defeated Imperial Japan, Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, and he didn't care about running up the debt, and because of that we are free today. God bless him, it was the right thing. President Harry Truman and President Ronald Reagan incurred similarly debt to end the Soviet Empire and the Cold War. God bless them. They gave to the next generation something in return for the duty to pay the debt. But I don't see it today. Examine our conscience as we might at the federal and state level and ask whether we have been borrowing in order to give our children something of priceless value, comparable to freedom from Nazism and Stalinist communism, or have we instead spent their money in vote-getting devices with the cost postponed, imposed on those too young to vote through the vehicle of budget deficits? I suggest that we resolve in the absence of national emergency, Democrat and Republican alike, that we propose no new or increased spending without identifying at the exact same time and in the same legislation the new revenue sources or cutting somewhere else. What's remarkable is that such a proposal should be considered remarkable. Thank you.
Our thanks to Tom Campbell, Dean of the Haas Business School of Business at the University of California at Berkeley, for his comments today. My name is Bob Saldick. I am chair of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors. I will be moderating today's audience question period. And Dean Campbell, we have a lot of questions, so let's plunge in. I guess the most timely one, in a way, is what are your thoughts about the speech last night, State of the Union, by President George W. Bush.
From the subject matter of my speech today, the war in Iraq, of course, was the dominant issue, but it isn't the dominant issue on the budget side. As I said, it will be over, God willing. We have not committed permanent expenditure. Yes, it is a huge fact right now, but from the point of view of the entitlement spending, it is not the cause of where we are today. Cause of where we are today is these permanent processes that I described. The president did speak about a new proposal in healthcare. I strongly think is the right one, to offer each of us individually the deductibility for healthcare, and I'm assuming that will be net revenue neutral to the federal government because he will then take away the tax deductibility for the employer. That also increases the portability of health care plan. And it blends rather well with the governor's proposal in California, where he intends to spend more state money for health care, and then the feds will pay 50% of that if it's through Medicaid, Medi-Cal in our state. So I think there's a good potential of those working well together. But I did not hear a commitment to the principle with which I concluded my remark, I maybe end by saying the Democratic leadership has said they wish to reestablish pay-as-you-go. I certainly hope that they can find the political will to do so.
Thank you. This is an economic forecasting session, so what is your forecast? Which sectors in the U.S. economy excite you most about the current situation, and which worry you the most?
Well, alternative energy is a huge place to invest, so invest to the extent of your means. It's only going to grow. The rates of return are very favorable, and I believe our need is quite great. So to the extent the dean of a public business school of the best, the Bank of America dean of the best public business school in the world is allowed to choose an industry, I'd say take a look at alternative energy. What worries me the most are the interest rate-sensitive industries, okay? Pretty straightforward, because when the market takes a downturn, we're not going to have that influx of money from China and OPEC to make up the difference. We're going to have to increase our borrowing. Interest rates go up. So any industry dependent upon keeping interest rates low is in trouble.
We have a flock of questions about health care, and let me just try to package them. Do you feel that the high health care costs have a major or a minor impact on the economy? How do you feel about Governor Schwarzenegger's health care proposal for the state of California? Will this be good for the budget? And what about health care? Should it be financed by taxes, by payroll, employment, job creation? How do we get out of this pickle of a weak health care plan?
We should pay for it. Not assume that the money will simply come in, not assume that it's okay to borrow it. So I don't want to see any of this being financed by general obligation bonds. How do we pay for it? Think about it for a moment. The tax that works best is the most broadly based, that doesn't punish somebody for hiring somebody in California. If I had a criticism of the governor's proposal, it would be that there is a 4% tax on employers. There is a 4% tax on hospitals, a 2% tax on physicians, and the doctors and physicians are very likely to pass on almost all of that to the insurers. This is an inelastic demand, and the result is going to be a higher cost to the person paying for the health insurance or the employer who must pay 4% or provide the health insurance. So the financing side ought to be broadly based. And another aspect is it doesn't on its face, neither the president nor the governors, pay for those who are unemployed. I mean, then it's just more of the same. But the unemployed person who doesn't have a wellness program or a preventive health care program, they'll be showing up at the emergency room again, the highest kind of cost. So that being the case, it would be wiser to finance the cost through a broadly based tax or cut somewhere else. I think the difficulty involved is getting two-thirds vote for it. But I'll conclude by this observation. Both in America and in the state of California, to offer an employer the following is a very attractive proposition. Come to California, hire people here, and the plain vanilla will be taken care of. Plain vanilla health care will be taken care of. If you want to offer your employees more, that's fine. Now you're offering some value. Yes, there will be a higher sales tax, would probably be my preferred way of going about it, but you're getting value for it. And who pays the sales tax? All of us, including those who are not here legally. Everybody pays the sales tax. So my expertise is more on the finance side, and I would like to see that correction made both at the federal and state level. Lastly, it always pays in the areas of comparative disadvantage with our other states if there's a federal solution. If California goes ahead with a costly solution that the other states don't have, the other states will make an attractive offer to the marginal employer to expand in Arizona or New Mexico or Oregon instead, or Nevada.
Well, thank you. There's been a great deal of discussion in the country in the last several years about tax reductions on high-income people. Would you comment on your feeling about that and also about the income inequality imbalance, which many people are very concerned about in the country?
The income inequality balance is a result of the departure of labor-intensive jobs to environments where labor is cheaper. I have not said anything profound. It's a straightforward rule of economics. Labor-intensive goods will be produced in countries where labor is cheaper. We can't change that. We can't repeal that. But we will produce goods that are capital intensive. They happen to be higher paying jobs. They happen to be the intellectual content being a higher percentage of those jobs. I don't think it is a bad thing that America has the advantage in capital intensive jobs. The key is not to lose those two. How do we lose those two? By telling qualified engineers, mathematicians, chemists, physicists, not to mention economists, when they get their PhD, that they have to leave our country. I don't understand the logic of exporting intellectual capital. We ought to welcome intellectual capital. We ought to expand the H-1B programs. We ought to go to those who are employing people who are the best around the world and say, thank you, not you now have to scramble to get fewer available visas. As to the income inequality argument in the tax consequence, I'd like to just share with you what I said during my speech, but I have the statistics here, and I'd invite you to go check on the web, the Congressional Budget Office website, http://www.cbo.gov, and check out the numbers for yourself. But here are the incidents for the United States. Top 1% of households are paying 22.6% of all federal taxes. Let me repeat that. Top 1% of households are paying the top 22.6%. Top 5% are paying 38.7%. Top 10% are paying 50.2% of all federal taxes. Top 10% paying more than half of all federal taxes. In the state of California, you can add about 20% to each of those numbers. Namely, the top 10% pays 70%. Top 10% in California pays 70% of the California income tax burden. The top third of California taxpayers, income taxpayers, paid 93%. 93% of all California income tax. So when people argue, all I want to do is make the wealthy pay their fair share, I argue that what more do you want? It's very difficult to see room without driving that person to another jurisdiction. And it's almost tautological that that's precisely the person with the means to live 187 days a year in Incline Village, Nevada.
Are you arguing for further reductions on the top earners?
I don't need to, and given the burden of my remarks today, I would have to cut somewhere else or increase taxes somewhere else. I will say that as an economist, I generally favor consumption taxes over investment taxes. What does that mean? Well, people don't do as much of that which you tax them for doing. So if I needed to raise $1, do I do it by taxing people for creating income, which I don't want to do, or do we do it by taxing people who consume? And what's the opposite of consumption? Savings. Income equals savings plus consumption. So it's logical to favor taxation on consumption. And given those numbers I told you about the high, steep nature of income tax at the federal and even more so at the state, that's not the place to go.
So flat tax is not something you would support?
No, that is correct. I would not. If you wanted to give me a revenue-neutral alternative, I would love to talk about a national sales tax to replace entirely the federal income tax. The danger of putting this forward, as sure as the sun rises tomorrow, unless we put it in the same constitutional amendment, we'll end up with both a national sales tax and a federal income tax. But if we could get the same constitutional amendment to repeal the income tax and to create a national sales tax and say that to be done at one time, that would be economically beneficial. And then how do you take care of the poor? By all means, exempt food and clothing and medicine and the cost of housing up to the median in any SMSA, in a standard metropolitan statistical district. And since the low-income folks spend almost all of their money on just those items, it's very fair to the poor. Result? You are not taxed for creating opportunity. You're not taxed for creating income. You're not taxed for employing somebody. And if you save your money, you're not taxed at all. Wouldn't that turn some of this around? We could actually finance our own expenditure instead of relying upon foreign sources.
That sounds good.
I'm all for it. Good. Thank you. I introduced it into the Congress when I was in Congress. I think I had three co-sponsors.
Talking about old taxes, how about Prop 13? Is that something that's guilty of causing all our problems, or should it be changed, or should it be supported?
You must recognize when I was finance director and was trying to make a pitch to companies to stay and expand, I had only one argument on the plus side, and that was Prop 13. They looked at what we did in the downturn of 2000 and 2003. They said, you're just going to stick it to us next downturn, but you can't stick it to us on property tax. And that's precisely what I mean by sinking concrete or building foundations in the state, right? So, no, Prop 13 was the only argument I had when I was arguing with companies to stay in California, that if you expand, if you put your new wafer fabrication plant here instead of in north of Flagstaff, Arizona, without identifying the company, you can guess, you don't have to worry about your tax on your property going up every year. It's already taken care of by Prop 13. There's some people who say a split roll, let's just tax businesses, precisely rebutting or contradictory to the argument that I just made. No, leave it clear. If California can send one clear message, come to California and you won't be whacked on your property tax once you're here.
What about illegal immigration? Would you reflect a little bit about the impact on the state and on the country of illegal immigration? How much does that contribute to our budget deficit?
The best studies I've seen indicate that illegal immigration is a net cost to the United States for the first 7 years of the person's presence and a net benefit thereafter. And that probably stands to reason if you reflect for a moment, because during the first 7 years, they're likely more to make use of the public facilities, including health care. And then after they've succeeded in 7 years, they're a productive member of the society and economy and a net paying more than they're taking out, particularly true in Social Security, right, where they have given a false Social Security number, so they're never going to see the FICA tax that they have been contributing to. So that's the seven-year split is roughly what I've seen qualified studies suggest. The issue, I think, can be straightforwardly put, much more difficult to solve it politically. The problem would be demonstrably reduced by substantial criminal penalties on those who intentionally hire those who are not here legally. The employer sanction has been virtually forbidden from discussion in any serious dimension, and it's not difficult to administer. You check the Social Security number the person gives you with an 800 number in Washington, find out if it's valid or not, and you can hire the person if it's valid and so forth. I've talked to employers who speak about the 200-yard rule. They'll check the documents at 200 yards, and if their eyesight is that good, then they'll go ahead. The other aspect that is controversial is a barrier, and let me say that controversial as it may be, when I come back from foreign trips, I go through a barrier at San Francisco Airport. I would like very much to be able to just go right through, not have my bags checked, and come back home. But there's a barrier. It is, in theory, in kind, in practice, no different from a barrier along our border. I don't see the logical difference. One is not as xenophobic and the other is. One is not racist and the other is. They are both reflections of our country's duty to protect its sovereignty and to invite those to become citizens whom we need. And if we took a little bit more from Australia's example on this point, we would have visas offered on the basis of proven industrial need. Give some visas to those PhDs graduating from Cal Engineering School, and a few to Stanford, too. So both, it seems to me, are components, a physical obstruction and the employer sanction. But the two political constituencies have a problem, the Republicans with the former, the Democrats with the latter. And so we don't have either.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Tom Campbell, Dean of the Haas School of Business at the University of California at Berkeley, who is discussing national and global economic issues for the year 2007. Let's move offshore a little bit, Tom, and discuss the euro. The euro is now a strong currency. Is it a competitor to the U.S. currency? What about China and the other countries which are taking so many of our jobs. You talked a little bit about outsourcing of jobs. How does that fit into our economic future? So what are your thoughts about all that?
Connecting the two, China is increasingly going to be investing its surplus in euros. We've already seen that. That's a fact. You remember in my remarks I pointed out that 10% of the federal debt is presently held by China and Hong Kong. I suspect that might not diminish, might grow, but that China has the option of investing in the euro. What that means for us is pretty straightforward. We no longer have that remarkable luxury of being able to borrow all we want without seeing interest rates go up at the federal level. We will see interest rates go up if we continue to borrow at the present levels. As to outsourcing, I view the realignment of jobs in the manner that I described of capital-intensive and labor-intensive. Are there things that China is doing that are not completely open in international trade? Yes, absolutely. It is not still an open economy. But with their accession to the WTO, China has much more opened its economy than it has heretofore and is on a path to being an effective member of WTO. You can repeal some laws. You can't repeal laws of economics. As long as China has the tremendously lower per unit labor cost, companies that are labor intensive will go there. And if the United States says, let's stop that by law, all we are doing is making our own companies less competitive against European and Asian competitors who will produce labor intensive goods in the comparatively advantageous positions, places in the world. So I view this as an opportunity for America to grow. Let us focus on preserving the heavy capital-intensive and intellectual capital-intensive jobs, and we have a positive future in our trade with China. And they are aware of and beginning to at least pay some political attention to the size of their surplus. One last point. Is the renminbi undervalued relative to the dollar? Yes, sure it is. It does not yet trade. So the time that we must await before we can completely say China is a member of WTO is the time when the renminbi is fully convertible. Then the market will decide. The price of goods that we purchase from China will rise as the renminbi costs more dollars, and the American goods will become more cheap to Chinese consumers as one renminbi buys more dollar-denominated goods. But that mechanism is right now impaired because the renminbi does not freely trade. That is the one remaining element, and that's where we should focus our diplomatic effort to correct.
Let's move to Europe. What about Russia and its using its economic power to sort of get its own way? Do you see any change in coming in our relationship with Russia these days?
I defer to my wife. Suzanne is the director of the Berkeley's program in St. Petersburg. Let me simply say that she tells me, and I hope this is reported to her, everything that I know about Russia. And I do exactly what she tells me in that regard. Having said that, what you see right now is a natural resource-driven economy. It has not diversified as it should. It is heavily natural gas and petroleum-driven, and that's as good as the price of oil. So President Putin is going to be in serious trouble when the price of petroleum falls even more, and obviously OPEC has got some difficulties right now. So his ability to bully with his sources of natural gas and petroleum is short-lived, and having tried it a couple of times, his client states are going to diversify their supply and diminish his ability to impress upon them his political will. For the long term, Russia needs to have a reliable system of enforceable contract. I want to say one thing very positive about Russia. The Consul General is here today. He's a friend of my wife and me, and I know of his own personal efforts. He has done a lot to convince the Russian government of the need to be open and to have reliable and enforceable contract. That is a task that can be undertaken more effectively by diplomats who have lived in foreign jurisdictions and report back the difference. So to Consul General Lejeune, I'd say well done, and I hope that your kind of influence is heard more in Moscow in the days ahead.
You mentioned that the Democrats have put forward a pay-as-you-go plan. and that's a that's an unusual position and strong position for them to take, and you've supported that. You, I believe, still identify yourself as a Republican. Why are you a Republican?
The odd thing is I thought that the Democrats were the free spenders and the Republicans were the fiscal conservatives. Something switched. I was service in Congress when President Clinton was in office and the budget balanced. I'm back in California when President Bush has been in office and the budget's way out of balance. So the party's short-term identifications have certainly changed. As to the pay-as-you-go, you could also call that Graham Rudman Hollings. So that had Democratic and Republican support. And remember, my whole point in my appearance here today is to say it's not a Democratic thing. It's not a Republican thing. All I'm asking is have a good Democratic versus Republican debate on what we should spend our money on and where the money should come from, income tax, sales tax, petroleum with withdrawal fee. Let's have that debate. But then if you want it, pay for it. I just don't want that to be viewed as a Republican or Democratic thing. So the questioner might implicitly have thought that pay-as-you-go is now owned by the Democratic Party. No, although the Republican control of the Congress has certainly not done my party any good in its reputation in that regard. And lastly, why am I a Republican? I'm the Bank of America Dean of the Walter A. Haas School of Business at the finest university in the world, and it's beneficial for me to be a nonpartisan dean. So the time may come when I can give you an answer to that question, but it's not today.
I asked Governor Schwarzenegger the same question a couple of months ago, and he gave a long response, which I think he had prepared. But he ended it by saying, besides, I sleep with a Democrat. Would you care to comment on that?
No.
We're seeing a sudden spirit of bipartisanship crop up in Washington, it appears. How long do you think it will last? And more fundamentally, what will it take for the people who are leading our political life to recognize the issues in much the way you have, which sounds awfully logical, and you're uniquely positioned now to answer all those questions.
I'm optimistic that right now, here in this moment, we might actually be seeing a substantial reorientation towards the bipartisan in our national politics. I take Speaker Pelosi at her word that she intends to govern with a more bipartisan tone. I do understand that she had to get legislation through in the first 100 hours, and that necessitated doing unto the Republicans what the Republicans did unto the Democrats when they were similarly constrained for time. I also remember when Newt Gingrich became Speaker, he said there would be almost all open rules on the House floor. The open rule means that anybody can make an amendment, as opposed to getting the approval of the Speaker in advance. To get the approval of the Speaker means the approval of the Rules Committee, and that means being the majority party. And over time, the Republicans' open rules became fewer and fewer and fewer. So there may be a cynic who would say the same will happen with Speaker Pelosi. I'm not going to be cynical today. Today I'm going to be hopeful. I think she's aware, and her colleagues on the Democratic side are aware, that they won an historic victory by positioning themselves as bipartisan, and I think because of the war in Iraq. The cynic might say none of this will happen because we're already in the presidential race. And I would respond to that cynic by saying Senator Barack Obama so far has said, elect me because I'll be bipartisan. And at least from what I perceive, he's getting a lot of traction with that position. So let me be optimistic and say that a good way for this to happen is through the rule that I proposed. Pay as you go, Graham Rudman Hollings. If you want it now, pay for it now or cut something else. Democratic and Republican can agree on that, and we've achieved a substantial amount of progress.
Do you expect a resurgence of moderate Republicans, asks one of our audience members.
Yes. I've got a bit of history here. There was a primary election for United States Senate in 1992. I came in second in that primary with 31% of the vote. Bruce Hershenson got 32.5% of the vote. Sonny Bono got 19% of the vote. Sonny ran as a moderate. God rest his soul, he's passed away now. But he ran as a moderate. So if you add his vote to mine, the moderates were strong. In the last head-to-head, it was a three-way race, but the last head-to-head contest, which presented that to the Republican electorate. Governor Schwarzenegger is a force unto himself, right? Can we agree? My opinion is he had been elected if he were independent. He would have been elected if he were Democrat, both in the recall and just recently. So it's not so much that he represents the future of the moderate wing of the Republican Party. Arnold Schwarzenegger represents a separate force in politics. He is in a class by himself. So what I would look for is the ability of the moderate wing of the Republican Party to come back to a fundamental tenet that used to hold the Republican Party together. Oh, so for the sake of coining a phrase, I'll call it Calvin Coolidge Republicanism. Very few devotees of Calvin Coolidge today. This would surely guarantee my obscurity in any future political environment. What kind of Republican are you? A Calvin Coolidge Republican. But unite the Republicans around pay as you go. Don't spend our children's money, as a moral as well as an economic dimension. Both conservative and moderate wing ought to be able to rally around that. And then the distinction between the moderate and the conservative group would essentially be the social issues. And on that, poll after poll shows that the majority of Republicans, at least in the state of California, favor a woman's right to choose, don't care if a person's gay or straight, and don't think that the Ten Commandments on the wall is the most important component of education in a classroom. I hope I'm not unfair in my characterizations, but basically that is the way to sort it out. Why do people who vote think about this? Not necessarily what you hear from the top elected officials. So from all of that, no, I don't think the moderate wing of the Republican Party is dead. It's just that I wouldn't say that Arnold Schwarzenegger's success proves that proposition.
The 2008 election, which is looming, are there any Democrats or Republicans that you think are aligned with your position right now?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, Senator McCain surely is on the economic issues, but not on the social issues. I don't know enough about Governor Romney. I hope I'm not being unfair when I observe that he ran as pro-choice and is now pro-life and had before running been pro-life. So I'm not quite sure about what he believes in that issue. And that's an important issue to me and to many. Rudy Giuliani, I had the honor to serve with in the Reagan administration. We were both in the Justice Department together. I have the highest admiration for Rudy Giuliani, and I wish him luck. I don't believe it's going to be easy for him to succeed in the Republican primaries. But in terms of social issues, he is certainly where the moderate Republican that I described might be. I might have disagreed with him on issues of enforcement, at least in some respects, of the securities laws, but that never gets into campaigns for president. And lastly, on the issue of the war, look, whatever your view on the Iraq war is, no Republican or Democrat, for that matter, is going to win for president who isn't believed by the voters to end the war in Iraq shortly after she or he becomes president. So the issue for a Senator McCain would be, can he plausibly say, we should have put more troops in, we didn't, that's over, it's irretrievable, let's pull out? Is that plausible? And can he do it in enough time to be convincing by the election? Otherwise, it's going to be very difficult for him. And for Mitt Romney, can he say, well, I never had anything to do with that? People will still say, well, what would you do? Senator Obama is lucky. He wasn't in the Senate. And apparently, as a state senator in Illinois, he did speak out against the war, which would put him in a very good position vis-a-vis Senator Clinton. In terms of social policy, On the Democratic side, there is, of course, a greater willingness to embrace what I've described as the moderate Republican agenda. The difficulty I'd have, at least presently, with the Democratic leadership is I haven't heard a reasonable plan for what you do to get out of Iraq. I've heard a real commitment to get out of Iraq, but I haven't heard a proposal that is carefully thought out. Maybe that will happen. And maybe I should give one last comment at the end. Senator Biden has done more thinking on this of a positive way, I think, than any other Democrat. And so if he can get behind ahead of the two colossi of Senator Clinton and Senator Obama, he seems like a very fine man.
Thank you. I can't resist, as we approach the end of this wonderful hour, throwing a couple of the audience's questions at you about your current position.
Well, the Haas School is now number 5 in national rankings from Wall Street Journal perspective. We are number 7 in United States News and World Report. We're number 8 in Business Week. We are unquestionably top 10. And knowing statistics as I do, this suggests that we can, within a standard of deviation, say we're number 1. You're welcome.
Well, now let me ask the question.
No, before that, I get the chance to brag. I'm going to brag about the school. We're superb in so many areas, but I just want to particularly say we teach students to be prepared to lead through innovation, because being static is no way to succeed in the growing economy. We teach students the skills to create opportunity. I don't call it create wealth. I say create opportunity. The skills to create opportunity and the values to share what you create. That's what makes us the best business school in the world.
So our final question. As dean of a major learning institution, comment on the rising cost of higher education. Will it be possible for the middle class to send their kids to college in 2020? And a second question. Coach Tedford makes more than 10 times the highest paid professor combined. Makes more than the 10 highest paid professors combined. Is this justified?
Yes. I am a free market economist. This man deserves every dollar he's been paid, and the market is the answer. He doesn't have tenure. The difficulty is, how can a free market economist plausibly stand before you with tenure? Very comfortably, thank you. And as to the cost of higher education, what I see for public education is a change, an important one in the model, and here it is. For those able to pay, we should go to the market. We should pay the market. And then take the incremental revenue to the University of California and use that at least in substantial portion, at least a third, for scholarships for those who can't afford. What we do now is to say everybody gets a subsidized tuition. The tuition is, what, $7,800 for undergraduate education at Berkeley? What is it at Stanford? 43,000? I was going to say 37, so
it's 37 without housing.
So 37 without housing. The 7,800 is without housing. So apples to apples, it's 37,000 to 7,800. And, of course, the quality of education at Berkeley is at least as good as that at Stanford. So, and it's, without chauvinism, there's both superb institutions. So that difference of $30,000 is an opportunity cost that could go to improving the quality of the Berkeley education even more, one-third of which then being returned in scholarships will keep that door open for the folks who don't have income. I'll conclude by saying one of the proudest aspects of being the Bank of America Dean of the Haas School of Business is this, that 25% of our undergraduate business majors, I'm privileged to be the dean of the undergraduate school, 25% are transfers from community college. Now, talk about an opportunity, door-opening opportunity. Many of these are children of folks who came here in very tough circumstances. Some are boat people. Some are here who never went to high school. And their children are now getting a world-class education at the University of California through the transfers from community college. I think that route should be enhanced every way that we can. Thank you very, very much.
Our thanks to Tom Campbell, Dean of the Haas School of Business at the University of California, for joining us. We also thank our audiences here in San Francisco and on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.